Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo, Alice Bryant, and Kelly Jean Kelly. But first, this report. In the United States, only about one-fourth of college graduates strongly believe their former schools would investigate claims of discrimination as best they can. That is a finding from an opinion study by Gallup, an American company known for its public opinion research. The study was published in May. Gallup researchers questioned more than 1,600 graduates of over 700 colleges and universities across the country. Each person completed a four-year study program between 2010 and 2019. The graduates were asked to base their answers on a 5-point rating system, with 5 meaning strongly agree and 1 being strongly disagree. The study found that just 27% of those questioned strongly agreed that their school would fully investigate claims of discrimination. John Clark is an education expert with Gallup. He says it is important to note which graduates were more likely to believe school officials would take necessary action against discrimination. Nearly 30% of white graduates strongly agreed that their school would fully investigate claims of discrimination. Yet only 19% of black graduates, 21% of Asians, and 23% of Hispanic graduates gave the same answer. Gallup did not say if its researchers questioned graduates belonging to other ethnic or racial groups. Clark suggests the differences are likely linked to the small numbers of blacks, Asians, and Hispanics in college faculty and administration positions. He noted that over the past 30 years, the U.S. college student population has grown more and more diverse. But many professors and school administrators are white and largely male. If students do not see people who share their life experiences in such positions, they are less likely to believe their school will take their issues seriously, Clark said. Rochelle Pope says she is not at all surprised by the study's findings. Pope is a professor of higher education studies at the University of Buffalo in New York. She is also the university's chief diversity officer. She notes that as far back as the 1970s, when she went to college, students were calling for more diverse faculty positions. But little has changed, even as colleges and universities have increased efforts to diversify the student body. One study published in January found that the number of full-time black faculty at Pennsylvania State University actually fell by about 2% over a 15-year period. Pope argues the root of the problem is that many Americans do not believe discrimination is a real problem. Yet a growing body of research provides evidence of racial inequality in many areas of American society, including policing, education, and finance. Colleges and universities are microcosms of the United States, Pope said. It's a microcosm of the big problems that we face. And so, if you don't deal with racism, with anti-black structures in your system in the United States, then you're not dealing with them in the campuses any differently. Pope said another issue is that higher education in general is slow to change, no matter what issue it is facing. Michigan State University and Ohio State University, for example, have only recently had to answer for years-old claims of sexual wrongdoing on their campuses. Shane Windmeyer is executive director of Campus Pride, a group that works in support of LGBTQ students. LGBTQ is short for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer or questioning. Windmeyer agrees that the speed at which colleges and universities deal with these issues is a problem. He told VOA, "Oftentimes, colleges play the waiting game with students, where they know that they'll be gone in 4 years or 5 years. And so it's like, oh, well, we lost that student, so what are we supposed to do? And colleges need to be held responsible on their own to create a safer, more inclusive campus community." Windmeyer added that the issue is not limited to just racial discrimination. After all, only 24% of LGBTQ students strongly agreed that their schools would fully investigate discrimination claims. That compares to 28% of non-LGBTQ students. Windmeyer noted a rising number of cases of students and faculty members claiming academic freedom and freedom of speech in defense of what he calls hateful statements. But he argues this is not about a difference in opinions or beliefs. It is about making all students feel welcome on campus. Windmeyer, Pope, and Clark agree U.S. colleges and universities must do more to gain the trust of their students. They say this starts with re-examining and strengthening discrimination policies, especially those related to employment and the admissions process. And it may lead to more schools making classes on discrimination and diversity a requirement for students, as the California State University system decided to do in July. I'm Pete Musto.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. That is the sound of someone diving off a diving board and into the deep end of a swimming pool. The deep end is where the water is the deepest. The water in the deep end is deep enough to dive in head first. Diving into deep water is fun and can make you feel very free. For a second or two, you fly through the air before going into the water below. If the water is deep enough and the pool rules permit it, it is safe to jump into the deep end. Some people may jump in wildly or without control. So it is not surprising that the phrase "off the deep end" has other meanings, besides simply jumping into a swimming pool. We use it in several situations. If someone has gone off the deep end, they have gone a little crazy. They have lost self-control. They have become angry or excited. When someone goes off the deep end, we can also say they have lost their mind.
Someone crashed into Tony's car, But don't tell him until after his birthday party. He loves that car and will go off the deep end when he hears the news.
Go off the deep end can also mean that you jump into a project without much preparation or thought. You do something on the spur of the moment, quickly and without thinking about the results.
Did you hear the news about Jake? He met a woman a month ago, and they just got married. Talk about jumping off the deep end.
Going off the deep end can mean you are acting in a very strange or extreme way. You seem irrational, like in this example. When my friends saw me laughing to myself, they thought I had dove right off the deep end. I told them that I had just won $10,000. Then they understood my seemingly crazy behavior. When we go off the deep end, we experience something in the extreme. We often use this expression when talking about strong emotions: love, anger, fear, and sadness.
I have never seen Aisha so in love. She's really fallen off the deep end over this new guy in her life.
These are things we lose our minds over. We lose emotional control.
Losing his job, apartment, and wife in 1 month pushed my friend off the deep end, not surprisingly.
Did you notice the different verbs we use with off the deep end? You can dive, fall, jump, or go off the deep end. And sometimes life's troubles can push you off the deep end. So those are the different meanings of the expression off the deep end and how we use them. I hope I didn't give you too many examples. That may push some listeners right off the deep end. And that's all the time we have for this Words and Their Stories. But join us again next week. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
With more than 2.5 million Ethiopians living outside of Ethiopia, the diaspora is not only large, but powerful. The Oromo are Ethiopia's biggest ethnic group. In 2015, members of the Oromo demonstrated in a small town about 80 kilometers from Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. They were protesting a development plan that aimed to expand the capital city into nearby Oromo towns and villages. The diaspora supported the protesters through social media activism and satellite television. The anti-government protests came before the resignation of then Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn in 2018. Awol Alo is a top lecturer at Britain's Keele University. He regularly writes on Twitter about political and Oromo developments. He does not think of himself as an activist. Alo says the diaspora's activity and influence depend on how the Ethiopian government reacts to free expression. When the new government came to power in 2018, the activism and influence of the diaspora lessened, he told VOA, because people in Ethiopia were able to express their views. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who is Oromo, took office in April of 2018. Generally speaking, Ethiopian politics moved back to the country when the opposition political parties moved back to the country, Alo said. But the diaspora has been speaking up again, he explained, because the government arrested some opposition politicians who had returned to Ethiopia. Conflict in Ethiopia began again in late June after the killing of Hachalu Hundessa, a popular Oromo singer and activist. Protests, some violent, followed his death. Police arrested opposition politicians. The government also blocked internet availability for 15 days. And Dalk Chala is co-founder of the blogging group Zone 9. He is also an assistant professor at Hamline University in the American state of Minnesota. Chala says the diaspora's powerful influence results from a lack of independent media in Ethiopia. There are two diaspora media outlets, Ethiopian Satellite TV and Oromo Media Network, he explained. Both had been giving detailed coverage of the protest, and people in Ethiopia did not have any other choices, he said. Because there was no media, opposition media, or independent media, for that matter, in the country. So people could only choose from the two outlets. In the beginning, the current government's National Unity Plan had popular support. And many exiled opposition activists and politicians returned to the country. In 2018, the government invited Ethiopian Satellite TV and Oromo Media Network to operate from Ethiopia. Many other Ethiopians also returned in hopes of supporting the changes. Ermias Kabedi organizes events for young people in his community in London. He moved back to Ethiopia in 2019. But, he says, he soon realized not everyone there welcomes the activism of the diaspora. He heard much criticism about the diaspora from coworkers and family members. People saw the diaspora as more of agitators, he says, but agitators who do not understand the effects of their actions. I'm Alice Bryant.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about George Walker Bush. He took office in 2001 as the 43rd president. He has a similar name to another president, his father, George Herbert Walker Bush. To simplify things, Americans sometimes call the younger Bush 43, or simply W. Here we will just call him Bush. Because Bush is a recent president, historians have not reached a broad agreement on his time as a leader. But he will surely be remembered for facing one of the biggest challenges to any president, the attacks against the U.S. on September 11, 2001. George Bush was born in the northeast state of Connecticut, but his parents soon moved to the southwest state of Texas. George grew up there and considered Texas home. The Bush family had a long background in politics. Bush's grandfather was a senator. His father held many public offices. In some ways, George was prepared for a career in politics, too. He went to the same private boarding school as his father. Then, like his father and grandfather, George went to Yale for college. He also worked on several political campaigns. But he said he did not consider pursuing politics. Instead, he earned a degree in business at Harvard and took a job in an oil company in Texas. In time, he founded his own oil business. And he married Laura Welch, who was a teacher and librarian in their hometown. They had twin daughters named Barbara and Jenna. In these years as a young adult, Bush began to make some changes. He began attending a Christian church regularly. He decided to stop drinking alcohol because it was creating problems in his personal life, and he turned his attention to politics. Bush lost the first election in which he competed, a race to become a member of Congress. So, for a while, he focused on business investments and helping his father's political career. But in 1992, his father lost re-election to the presidency, and the younger Bush saw a chance to enter politics himself again. In 1994, Bush ran for governor of Texas. To many people's surprise, he won. 4 years later, he was overwhelmingly re-elected. Many voters liked his image as what he called a compassionate conservative. In other words, he wanted to use traditional Republican ideas about government to help society. Following two successful terms as governor, Bush turned his attention to the presidency. In 2000, he competed against the vice president at the time, Al Gore. The winner was not announced until more than a month following the election. Usually, the winner is announced within hours. Both sides disputed the process of counting votes in the state of Florida. Finally, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on the process. The court ordered state officials to stop recounting votes. Bush's lead stood. Bush entered office expecting to bring many of the ideas he pursued in Texas to the entire nation. For example, as president, he permitted religious groups to receive government funding and set national standards for public schools. These moves were popular with many voters, but they also challenged some American traditions. The separation of church and state and the ability of public schools to govern themselves. For many presidents, these policies might have created a legacy. But early in Bush's term, he faced a crisis that defined much of his time in office. Hijackers linked to the Al-Qaeda group seized four airplanes on September 11, 2001. They purposely crashed two planes into the twin towers of the World Trade Center in New York City, eventually killing more than 2,700 people. Another plane was flown into the Pentagon, the country's military headquarters outside of Washington, D.C. About 200 people died there. The fourth plane was aimed at another important target. But passengers fought the hijackers. The plane lost control and crashed in a field in Pennsylvania. All 44 people on board died there. President Bush was visiting an elementary school in Florida that morning. He learned about the attacks while he was reading with the children. At the end of the day, Bush spoke to the nation. He said the U.S. would answer both the terrorist groups and the countries that permitted terrorist groups to thrive. Over the next years, Bush took a number of actions to create a new national security strategy. They included creating a Department of Homeland Security, making changes to the country's intelligence operations, and reforming the U.S. military. He also sent U.S. forces into Afghanistan to destroy terrorist networks there. Bush was especially targeting the person who had designed the September 11 terrorist attacks, Osama bin Laden. The struggle in Afghanistan was successful at first, but continued throughout Bush's time in office. And bin Laden was not captured while Bush was president. In 2003, Bush opened another front on what some called the War on Terror. He and other government officials said the leader of Iraq, Saddam Hussein, was developing weapons that could kill many people. They said Hussein and his connections to terrorist groups threatened Americans and people in other countries. Hussein did not agree to leave Iraq, so U.S. and British forces launched bombs at targets in the country's capital. Additional troops destroyed what was left of the targets. Hussein was quickly overthrown. But the weapons of mass destruction were not found. For the rest of Bush's presidency, U.S. forces remained in Iraq. Bush promised that Americans would stabilize the country and help Iraqis create a democratic government. The presidency of George W. Bush is too recent to understand its impact. But there is some evidence of the public's reaction at the time. Bush received some of the highest ratings of any president. In the weeks following the September 11 attacks, 90% approved of his leadership. He was re-elected in 2004. But his popularity steadily decreased. At the end of his second term, he had one of the lowest public approval ratings of any president, 33%. The U.S. economy had entered a recession. More Americans disagreed, especially with his decision to invade Iraq, and some criticized his government for responding too slowly after Hurricane Katrina struck New Orleans and the country's Gulf Coast. Since Bush left the White House in 2009, his approval ratings have, like those of many presidents, risen again. He has mostly avoided public appearances. Instead, he has enjoyed playing sports, helping charities, and reading U.S. history. He also began a new hobby, painting. He has created portraits of dozens of veterans to honor their service in the military. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.